Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So it's nice to have some a larger group staying at the monastery this weekend and coming together for our Saturday night sitting and reflection on Dhamma. It's something that the Buddha recommended for practitioners, certainly in the time of the Buddha, and it's recorded in the suttas, even though he would encourage the monks and the nuns to dwell in the forest and to practice alone and intently, he did also encourage them to come together and reflect on Dhamma, maybe at least once a week. Yeah, so we have the Upasita gatherings, or the gatherings around in the lunar calendar, around the half moon, the full, and the new moon. It's quite typically when the monastics would gather. And here in the West, we're going on the solar calendar, and it seems like although we still follow the lunar calendar, but we tend to have our meetings to reflect on Dhamma midweek and on the weekend, so as this allows people from outside to come, to know when it's going to happen, to come and join us. Because as you know, the lunar days change, they don't stay consistently, the one day in the 7 day calendar. So here at Santi we do our Wednesday nights and our Saturday night gatherings, and it's a good rhythm to get into. And even if there's just a couple of us, or 10 of us, or whatever, we still do it. And the Buddha talked about the benefits of both hearing Dhamma, contemplating the Dhamma, and also for the teachers, those who were teaching Dhamma. There are benefits for each of us, and we have many examples in the suttas of disciples of the Buddha actually awakening to different stages, either the sotapanna or the full awakening through listening to a desana of the Buddha. And he often said, you know, that listening to the Dhamma was one of the causes for awakening. And even for a teacher, having to put themselves in the place of reflecting on Dhamma can be beneficial, because I don't know what I'm going to say. I don't necessarily plan what I'm going to say in this tradition of monasticism. In fact, we're very much trained and encouraged just to reflect from the moment, because it's a very different place to speak from the moment rather than prepare a talk ahead of time. Each have their benefits, but preparing a talk ahead of time tends to keep not only the teacher but often the listener in more of a theoretical, intellectual mode of being. Whereas in the forest tradition, there's very much a training about staying connected to the heart when listening to Dhamma, when teaching Dhamma, and just speaking out of one's own experience in the moment. So when you're listening to Dhamma, often when you read or hear talks from Ajahn Chah, he would encourage the listeners to listen with your heart, not with your ears. The ears are too close to the brain and we start to think about things. But to listen with the heart means you listen with an open mind, and to allow the heart just to reflect, just to take it in and reflect on the Dhamma. And this is the most beneficial way of hearing the Dhamma, that you're actually looking at your mind, looking at the heart, aware of what's present in your heart as you're listening. Because the Dharma of the Buddha is very much about what's here and now. In fact, that's one of the characteristics of the Dharma. It's apparent here and now. It's timeless. We're not bound by time. It's available to be seen. It's there to be seen. Each wise person for themselves. Now this can sound a little bit cryptic to us, but when we really examine what is this Dharma that we're interested in, what is it that the Buddha's pointing to, what is he teaching us? And perhaps if I asked everyone in this room, what is the Dharma for you, maybe we each have a different idea of what that is, or we come at it from a different angle, or we have a different sense of what's meaningful for me. And perhaps even at different stages of our life, or even perhaps one day to the next, if we're asked that question, we might come up with something a little bit different. So I don't know about you, but for me the Dhamma is always about apprehending the truth of the reality of this life, what this life is about. You know, we become so conditioned to existing, if you like, getting by in the world, learning how to relate, learning how to function in the world. We become so conditioned by that, the older we get, we often lose the sense of wonder at just the fact of existence, the fact of being. And part of what happens with meditation, when we learn how to come back into the present moment, how to be present more and more, how to keep an open mind, how to not just be fooled by our thinking mind, believing every thought that it throws at us, we can slowly come back into that place of just being. And it's a really wonderful place of contemplating Dhamma. Dharma being truth or reality or the way it is. And that's exactly what the Buddha's encouraging us to do, to contemplate just this experience of being. You know, and we have all sorts of ideas about it, and all sorts of desires we bring to that experience, and fears, conditioned desires. Perhaps conditioned hopes, even our ideas of nibbana or freedom from suffering may be very much theoretically based or head based, you know. But to become aware of what's actually going on in this heart mind in the moment is what this practice of meditation and contemplation affords us. And again, I don't know about you, but for me, what when I first came into contact with the Buddha's teaching when I was in my early 20s, I didn't quite know what I was looking for, really, you know. But I was on a bit of a spiritual search, fueled by all sorts of existential questions. Which perhaps I couldn't even articulate very well. But from the experience of my life to date at that time, I was very much aware of an experience of emotional suffering, because my life, I'd grown up pretty, in pretty good circumstances. There were no, just the usual traumas of childhood. in various ways, but nothing out of the ordinary that would account for this feeling of suffering. And I'm aware also that many young people go through that stage as well, trying to grapple with the world, trying to understand what we've been born into, trying to understand the dynamics in our family, dynamics in society. Growing up in the 60s and 70s, television was relatively new to society, and, you know, it wasn't as sophisticated and as horrid as it is now. But, you know, I was very much aware of it as a kid of the kind of, through the nightly news, my parents liked to watch news after news and then current affairs, but the kind of level of suffering in the world, you know, all these reports of suffering going on in the world around us. I wasn't sophisticated to understand the way media worked, you know, and the choice to sensationalize all the horrors in the world, but very acutely aware of why is there so much suffering in the world, but also looking around me and in families of some of my friends, aware of suffering there, aware of suffering, certain kinds of suffering in my own family when there were arguments or when our dear pets died or something terrible happened, the difficulties at school. You know, but yet all of these outer things were one kind of suffering, but on another level, I was very much more and more aware of it, an inner suffering, an inner kind of emotional state of, let's say, right now I could call it maybe confusion, just not understanding, and the kind of sense of suffering that goes along with that. Not understanding, not knowing, being aware of what I would now call dukkha, having understood what that concept is about, what that word points to, being aware of dukkha internally as a conscious, emotional, sensate being aware of dukkha externally in the relational world of society around me, and also aware of the dukkha of just not understanding, not knowing what this was about. And yet there, for me, there was also this quite intense seeking or inquiry, somewhat of a driving force, or wanting to know. But it was on quite an intuitive level. You know? So as a kid, we have to go through the motions, don't we? We naturally trust in our parents. We're under the authority of our parents. We learn to do what they tell us and guide us to do. We're under the authority of our teachers at school and in various ways, and so we're learning through what they teach us, whatever our society deems to be worthy of instilling in children. That's what we take on. Yeah. What was worthy when I was growing up was barracking for the football teams, making sure you went to church on Sunday, as I said earlier today, I think, or yesterday. Waking up in my early teens a bit to the fact, well, I don't think everyone goes to church on Sundays and football on Saturdays, you know. But up until then it was like this globalized, oh, that must be what everyone does, you know, this globalized sense. But, you know, as you get older and as you contemplate the process of conditioning, we are conditioned into our society, into our familial values, our societal values, the predominant religious value, whichever the society is upholding or our family is upholding. We're emotionally and psychologically conditioned by our own personality characteristics of our parents and our siblings and the people we hang out with at school. You know, so many different levels of conditioning. No wonder it's a confusing time. We've got so many growth spurts going on and chemicals running around the body mind in different stages of growth. You know, it's quite surprising we come through relatively intact. Many people don't, in fact. You know. But, you know, for those who are fortunate enough to have enough stability in their family, enough wholesomeness, enough good enough holding, as some of the early relational psychologists would talk about, you come through with enough skills, enough resources to try and make your own way once you become a young adult. And of course then you have the opportunity to explore more widely, so what's this all about then? You know, this existence, it's this life. Now, I consider myself quite fortunate to have grown up in the 60s and 70s, because by the time I became a young adult, the world was still a very, it didn't feel like a dangerous place to me. You know, these are just perceptions, but you know, the 70s, you know, emerging out of the 60s, free love, and the 70s was still very much affected by that and profound emergences in the arts, in the realms of art, in the realms of music, you know, great kind of surges of creativity and a lot of spiritual seeking as well, coming through those artistic creative mediums. And this was all affecting my own ways of thinking and being as well. And to travel the world at that time was didn't appear to be so dangerous or even so expensive. And so after I'd done my college years, trained as an artist, which also encouraged a lot of my existential questioning and turning into a deep spiritual inquiry, I found myself able to work for a while, save up enough funds to travel the world with a friend. And certainly it was a time of inquiry and searching. So what's the rest of the world like? And as many of you know, because many of us are of a similar age, this is pre-internet, pre-World Wide Web. So you don't have instant access to Google Earth or the media. You know, we weren't plastered with images of the rest of the world. So really discovering the world was quite a discovery, to actually physically, you know, make your way to different countries and go trekking and traveling and whatever, discovering different cultures, different people who were conditioned in different ways, if you like, and traveled through Southeast Asia and Europe to England. But by the time, I don't know why I'm telling you my story, but I hope it's a little bit interesting. we'll get through to some more interesting pieces. But you know, by the time I did get to England and started working as a young adult over there, something in me said, okay, the answers aren't out there. You know, I'd been, a big part of me had been traveling in order to look to see how's everyone else dealing with this stuff, you know. How's everyone else coping? Do they have any better answers than we had in the Sutherland Shire or in Australia, you know? How are they dealing with the internal and external suffering, this existential predicament? And again, it wasn't a theoretical, it wasn't an intellectual inquiry. It was very, very intuitive, direct, experiential inquiry. And something in me had concluded, yeah, well, no one else seems to have any clearer answers about how to do this thing any better. You know, everyone else, in all, at least though, the places I moved and travelled through, and, you know, it looked pretty much, you know, life as in Australia, but under the guise of different cultural practices, different, certainly different standards of living in different places, but pretty much the same, yeah. So something clearly said to me in England, well, yeah, the answers aren't out there. I've got to look inward. And immediately, since I've really got to learn how to meditate properly, yeah, because I'd done a bit of meditation when TM swept through the colleges in Australia, which was, you know, my college years were a bit of a spiritual discovery too. Some of the 70s spiritual books coming through and the TM meditation. But it was still at a time in my life where, you know, there was still so much to discover in other parts of life and living as a young adult. So it didn't take hold of me too strongly. But now, as I was about 23 or so, and a much more serious, well, it has to be inward. I have to learn how to meditate properly. And just a whole series of, synchronic events led me to places where I could learn to meditate, and recommended to go to Amaravati Monastery too, where I originally ended up taking ordination for the first time back in the late 80s by then. So, you know, this is my kind of story, but I'm sure each of you will have your own take, your own kind of, when you look back, what's brought you to this moment, what's brought you to the Dhamma, what's brought you to this inquiry, this spiritual path, in whichever way you're picking it up or walking with it or inquiring into it. So for me, it was very much about this quandary, if you like, about the experience of suffering and the feeling of not quite understanding, but having a sense, having a strong intuition that if I could understand this, peace would be possible. So somehow this came through in my own searching and seeking. And that's why when I did first meet the Dhamma in its fullness, which is when I first went to Amaravati Monastery and had booked myself on a 10-day meditation retreat taught by one of the monks, when he started teaching the Dhamma and continued for 10 days, it was like, aha! It was like meeting an old friend in a way, not so much in the teacher but in the teaching. It was also a bit of a revelation that there was so much of it to know, to understand, and this path of meditation was a means by which we could deepen the inquiry into this truth. But what I remember of that retreat was first hearing the Four Noble Truths, probably because the experience of suffering internally and externally, or perception of it, was a predominant kind of aspect of my spiritual existential search, if you like. To hear the Four Noble Truths articulated as the Buddha articulated them was revelatory in a way. So the way that he just talks, just says, well, there is this truth of dukkha, of suffering. It is a fact of existence. It's like, ah. And what it revealed to me in just hearing that first truth was my underlying driven assumption that my experience with suffering, of suffering, meant that something was wrong with me. That something was wrong. But here the Buddha's declaring that there is suffering, it is a fact of existence. There is this experience of unsatisfactoriness, of dukkha, of something not quite feeling right, of incompleteness, let alone the actual physical pain we have to encounter, or the deeper emotional pain of loss or despair or grief or confusion that we often encounter. Let alone that, there is also this aspect of dukkha, which is just a sense of unsatisfactoriness. So this, I don't know if it strikes you to any degree now, but just to hear this for the first time actually relieved me of a sense of feeling that somehow, at some level, this is my fault, which is probably partly to do with the Christian conditioning that I was exposed to, where, you know, born in original sin, the whole idea that, you know, one has to repent. I never really took that on consciously, though, I don't think, but nevertheless it goes in to a young mind. But even if one's not brought up Christian, the Western world is very much dominated by this Judeo-Christian view of a kind of a punishing God, an original sin. You know, which has its own way of, you can work things through it once you mature out into a kind of a rational thinking adult. But it, you know, it has its impact on you as a kid and on the psyche of the beings that you live with. So from the point of view of the Buddha, looking at these Four Noble Truths, suffering is a fact of existence, in conditioned existence, because conditioned existence is always a process of change. So even when we find something that's pleasant or something that makes us happy, those conditions are bound to change, and so it leaves us again, if we haven't developed wisdom into this predicament, it robs us of our happiness when those things change. So this is to be looked into and to be seen. Ultimately, the Buddha's message is about, you know, don't, and we hear Ajahn Brahm saying it in different ways too, don't search for happiness in a place where there is no happiness. We have this that very famous saying of a Zen monk in his own enlightenment, own realization. Ah, joy at last to realize there is no happiness in the world. Now how can that be so? He doesn't sound like he's dying in despair because there's no happiness in the world. It's joy at last. Why is that? Because he can stop seeking for something that doesn't exist. And the freedom that comes of being released from that dogged search, blinkered search, is actually the release that the Buddha is pointing to as possible. The happiness of Nibbana that doesn't depend on conditions, that doesn't depend on the conditioned world being a certain way, but it depends on understanding the nature of the conditioned world, the nature of the conditioned existence of body-mind, and in the wake of that understanding, also understanding the unconditioned, the mind which is no longer affected by clinging, the mind which is freed out of that seeking driven by greed, hatred and delusion, the compulsion. So this is the joy, this is the happiness, this is the freedom, the liberation that the Buddha is pointing to, which is declared in the Third Noble Truth. The Second Noble Truth, the first being there is suffering, this fact of existence. The Second Noble Truth is it arises, it actually arises, it has a cause. It's not actually a permanent state, it has a cause, it arises. And if it arises, it also ceases. It has a cause. That cause is impermanent, is conditioned. If we discover the right view, the right understanding, we can come to see how the suffering that arises can come to cessation. But for this, we have to know the path. We have to know the Fourth Noble Truth, the path, the way that leads to the complete ending of suffering, or the way that leads to the end of suffering. We have to understand what that path is about, the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's not necessarily a path drawn out in linear time that we have to go step by step, get our first degree and second degree and to the eighth degree, whatever, and then we get it. In fact, it's, you know, the instantaneousness of this path is reflected in many of the Buddha's teachings. Through a full understanding, a full and clear comprehension of the fact that all that arises ceases and is not self. This is the insight of the Aryas. In the Buddha's first teaching to the first five disciples, his previous companions who were ascetics, he went back and he taught about his understanding, the arising of this clear understanding of the Four Noble Truths, which actually destroyed delusion and brought his liberation to completion. And at the end, he was talking about how these Noble Truths are seen, and the fact that all conditioned existence have these characteristics of of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, because of their changing nature, their impermanence, their anicca, dukkha, and the not-self nature of these changing conditions. These are all related, these three characteristics of existence. We can look at any experience and we can see the characteristics of anicca, impermanence, of dukkha, and satisfactoriness or stress, and anatta, the not-self nature, or the nature of the experience, which is empty of a permanent self, empty of a solid self. Why is it empty of a solid self? Because it is changing, and when it's seen to be changing, it cannot sustain this notion of me, mine, what I am. We can't apply it to something that has now here, now gone. You know, and actually this search for who am I, which is pretty much the kind of search of humanity in spiritual traditions, you know, comes to a grinding halt when we see these experiences clearly, when we see these conditions clearly. And it's not that as if that in its wake of seeing anicca, dukkha, anatta, that there is no experience at all. But in the wake of understanding the cessation of suffering, the Buddha says the citta is liberated, the heart is liberated, liberated from greed, hatred, delusion, liberated from suffering. So there is that which experiences nibbana, that which experiences liberation, that which has the full, now the fullness of wisdom. So this experience of nibbana is not the annihilation of things, it's the full understanding of the conditions and the unconditioned reality. So it's very hard to point to the unconditioned reality with words and ideas, because it's actually something beyond our an intellectual grasp. It's not being its nature being unconditioned. It's actually beyond the realm of speech or description, but it's not beyond our capacity to experience and to know directly. So when we talk about this knowing directly, this is something that we develop in meditation, as simple as knowing the breath directly, not through the apparatus of intellect or thought, but just meeting sensation directly. That quality of knowing of mind that knows things directly is where this path is cultivated. The path, the qualities that will bring the mind to the direct knowing of nibbana, of the unconditioned. Because it lies right here, it's nowhere else. It's just occluded, our vision is occluded by these conditions of greed, hatred, delusion, confusion. Yeah. So the experience of the unconditioned arises here and now. The reality of the unconditioned exists here and now, but it must be realized, penetrated to, with the wisdom mind, with the knowing mind, that which knows directly. To conceive of it and hang on to that concept is just that, hanging on to a concept. It's not the direct experience. And the Buddha said it's only the direct experience that releases the heart, that destroys ignorance. So this is hard to understand from an intellectual point of view, but when you develop the meditation, you come to understand what these words are pointing to more and more. You come to understand when the Buddha describes the conditioned reality, he's just describing this body-mind. The way we experience it directly, we experience rupa or form through the aspect of sensation. And the mental factors of feeling tone, perception, mental formations, the thoughts, ideas, notions, the sense consciousness, the moments of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. These are the five khandhas. The five khandhas are the conditioned realm. The extent of the five khandhas is the extent of the conditioned realm. Yeah, so this is what we can come to know and observe in our experience. And when we see the conditioned in our experience, we know it arising and ceasing, it's momentary, it's changing, it comes, it goes. It's driven by karma and conditions, various laws of conditionality. When we develop a quality of knowing that can just know things as it is, as they are, and rest out of this conditioned push-pull relationship to it, the wanting and the not wanting, the desire and aversion. When the mind learns how to rest out of that, it settles naturally into a state of, it's very hard to even call it a state, but naturally, it settles naturally into the inherent knowing of the mind. And that knowing can know the conditioned and the unconditioned. The unconditioned, if you like, if I dare to put words that the Buddha did not give to it. A lot of teachers point to training the mind to see between the gaps of the arising and ceasing of conditions. To notice the stillness, to notice when things end and come to cessation. To notice the silences, the gaps, the space, the stillness between the happenings, the experiences, the things that keep arising and ceasing. When there's a direct knowing of that which is not arising and ceasing, this is where the realization of the unconditioned occurs. But very, very hard to put words to it. And even when we do put words to it, the mind conceives of something and attempts to get it through following its concepts, which is natural, the natural conditioning of the mind. And we need some sense of how to practice, how to be with the conditions. This is why a lot of the Buddha's teaching is actually pointing to knowing the conditions. Because once your knowing is so clear about the conditions, then it's inevitable and unmistakable, the penetration of the unconditioned. Because the conditioned realm is not permanent. The things that arise and cease come to cessation. And when the mind has been trained to rest in stillness, then inevitably it will come to penetrate to what's called the deathless or the unconditioned. So the Buddha tries to teach us this natural process of cultivating these spiritual powers or strengths within the mind that allow, that eventually bring us to this penetration. But what does that mean? Again, it's very hard to bring into the realm of the mundane, but basically in different Buddhist traditions we're talking about penetrating the ultimate nature. So when we go back to that question of who am I, although we might rephrase the question, you know, to penetrate to the ultimate nature of conditioned and unconditioned is really going to supply the answer, right? But it may be that once the mind penetrates the unconditioned, the I word no longer makes sense, because it's a penetration to a universal reality, if you want to put those words on it. But all these kind of words of descriptions kind of fall short of the ultimate reality that the Buddha is pointing to, which is why he's perpetually telling us it can only be realized directly. It can't be grasped intellectually. But he assures us that this is the heart's longing, really, to know this truth, to find this freedom. And it doesn't mean that this body-mind completely falls off the face of this planet, because this body-mind is a result of past karma. So we live this life with the resultant effect of the past karma. But with a realized mind, with a mind that is fully awakened, there is no more suffering generated in relation to it. Even if the body suffers illness and pain, the mind knows that, but at a very minimum level, knows how to bear with that. But there's absolutely no mental or emotional suffering created around it, because the understanding that this is just the residue of karma, it just has to be born with. It's very hard for us to really conceive this perspective, but sometimes helpful to get a sense of the territory that we're exploring in this path of practice, working to understand the conditioned reality, which is this very body-mind, the experiences we have. But we have this ability to discern both the conditioned and the unconditioned. And this is the ultimate goal of the Buddha's path. So through the fourth noble truth, the path to liberation from suffering, we talk about as sila, samadhi, panya, those different factors of cultivating wholesomeness, letting go of the unskillful in our mundane life, but also developing the meditative skill. So as we can look, like a scientist looks through the microscope at the inner workings of the natural world, so we must learn to look through the microscope of the refined mind to understand the building blocks, how this body-mind, how this sense of self arises, how it comes into existence, how the experience of suffering arises in relation to that, through this mechanism of grasping, of ignorance, craving, clinging. Something to be seen. And when it's seen clearly, fully understood, it's like the whole experience of suffering just unravels. The unbinding, which is the English word for nibbana, the unbinding of awareness, or the release of awareness, the freedom of awareness, or the freed heart. So just offer these words for your contemplation tonight, and hope they've been helpful.